This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Earth Day will celebrate its 51st year this month, and we'll get the latest on a local organization that's been an advocate for the environment for 50 years.
There's a lot of issues that touch the environment, whether that's wildlife, water, air, land, transportation. So it's been really important for EcoSlo over the past 50 years to build coalition.
Also, we'll hear from Cal Poly President Jeffrey Armstrong.
Students do better if they live on campus for 2 years versus living that second year in the community. Some dispute that, but the data is clear.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, April 12th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. A gray wolf made a brief appearance in Monterey County this week on an historic journey south from Oregon. His presence is also noteworthy for the agricultural community. Experts say spreading awareness about this protected wolf is essential in minimizing wolf-livestock conflicts. KAZU's Michelle Loxton reports.
Gray wolf OR93 is an approximately two-year-old male from northern Oregon. He was fitted with a tracking collar in June of 2020, and that data has revealed an epic journey south of almost 1,000 miles. Jordan Traverso is spokesperson for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife.
This wolf, OR93, which represents the 93rd wolf that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has collared, has come the farthest south than any other wolf we've seen since wolves have returned to the state.
Wolves had not been seen in California for close to 100 years when they started to return in 2011. Traverso says this wolf has traveled an enormous distance since he arrived in the state at the beginning of this year. He kept mostly to the counties on the state's eastern border along the Sierra Nevada. But when he reached central California, he turned right, eventually making it into Monterey County. He didn't spend long, though, and by Tuesday had been detected in San Luis Obispo County. Besides the significant and historic distance, OR93's journey has been a dangerous one, with him crossing busy freeways.
It's crossed 99, 5, and at this point, US 101, which is really, really amazing. Wildlife gets hit by cars all the time, and these are major, major freeways.
This isn't the only concern for the gray wolf, says Traverso. There's also rodenticides, chemicals that kill rodents, that he could come across when he reaches more populated areas. And sometimes humans mistake the protected wolves for coyotes, which are legal to hunt in California. And this is where ranches come in.
One wolf does not pose a significant threat, but it still is another apex predator that does feed off of cattle or deer or other small animals.
Traverso's advice to ranchers and anyone concerned about the presence of a gray wolf is similar to that of Monterey County Agricultural Commissioner Henry Gonzalez. Leave him be.
They should not harass or try anything to distract the wolf from what it's doing. Just leave it alone. If you want to make a notation and share that with others in the area, that would be a good thing.
Gonzalez says the wolf's presence is noteworthy as Monterey County's agricultural industry goes beyond field crops with about 1 million acres of rangeland where livestock roams. He doesn't want his county making any bad headlines.
We don't want anyone to mistake a gray wolf, this particular gray wolf, for a coyote, and then shoot it.
Gonzalez isn't too concerned about the impact if any one wolf could have on local livestock, adding that many ranchers already have defenses in place to protect their animals from coyotes, which should be sufficient for wolves too. Where this wolf heads next and if he'll be back is unknown. What we do know is he's out searching for a new food source, or a new territory, or a mate. For Jordan Traverso, the California Fish and Wildlife spokesperson, this epic journey is a positive story for the state, which used to be historic wolf habitat. A story that could ensure there are wildlands for animals that belong here, to stay here. Animals like gray wolf OR93.
KAZU's Michelle Loxton reports. On April 22, 2021, Earth Day will celebrate its 51st year. But environmental pioneers and poets have been writing about the need to care for our planet much longer. A new audio production called Voices of the Earth presents thoughts about the environment from across the ages. KCBX contributor Beth Thornton reports.
Voices of the Earth is a performance of historical and contemporary readings about the environment from the world's influential thinkers and leaders.
Crowfoot, 1890.
What is life? It is the flash of a firefly in the night. It is the breath of a buffalo in the winter time. It is the little shadow which runs across the grass and loses itself in the sunset.
Rush Rem is a theater and classics professor at Stanford University. He worked with co-creator Charles Yunkerman on this production for the Stanford Repertory Theater. Rem says the play features staged readings by students and professionals.
We decided that it wouldn't just be about contemporary thoughts about the environment, but to go back to the ancient Greeks, to Sanskrit, to earlier societies.
Rem and Yunkerman imagined the production as a celebration of environmental pioneers in an open-air theater surrounded by trees on the Big Sur coast. The location, well known to nature lovers, is often considered one of the most beautiful places on Earth. But due to the pandemic, Rem and Yunkerman reimagined the live performance as an audio play.
A narrative play on the environment, not as an original script, but as a compilation of great writing on the environment, of which there is just an enormous amount.
The performance brings to life the work of 60 writers who have, across centuries, contributed to our understanding of the natural world. The writings are by thinkers such as playwright Sophocles from ancient Greece, explorer John Muir, known as the father of national parks, and biologist Rachel Carson, who wrote about the damaging effects of pesticides. The list also includes Native American voices, poets, and activists. Rem says he hopes listeners will realize that environmentalism is not a new issue.
One can find the roots of resistance to environmental deprivation and degradation from way, way back.
The audio play illustrates the power of nature to inspire great writing and also delves into the troubled relationship between humans and the natural world.
Sophocles, 440 BC.
Numberless wonders, terrible wonders walk the world.
But none the match for man.
The Henry Miller Library in Big Sur was the planned venue for the live performance. The library's executive director, Magnus Torin, says the Redwood Canyon behind the library is a beautiful location for outdoor theater. He's pleased the group pivoted to an audio production and describes Voices of the Earth as both inspirational and educational.
As we all know, there are many, many challenges that we are facing. But in all of that, we must never forget how exceptionally beautiful it is that we get to live on Earth together.
Stanford Continuing Studies offers the Voices of the Earth script and materials to educators and non-commercial groups through their website, free of charge, with one request: to work together to save the planet.
John Muir, 1894.
Climb the mountains and get their good tidings. Nature's peace will flow into you as sunshine flows into trees. The winds will blow their own freshness into you, and the storms their...
KCBX is broadcasting 3-minute segments of Voices of the Earth at 11:57 each weekday morning throughout the month of April. To access the full 85-minute program, a series of shorter audio segments, or the full printed text of Voices of the Earth, go to stanfordreptheater.com. For the KCBX Arts Beat, I'm Beth Thornton.
The KCBX Arts Beat is made possible by a grant from the Shanbrom Family Foundation. The Environmental Center of San Luis Obispo formed in 1971, and their first published newsletter in 1976 was called The Earth's Advocate. Today, EcoSlow is still advocating for the environment. KCBX contributor Dr. Consuelo Mukes speaks with the executive director.
This is the nonprofit story. I'm Dr. Consuelo Mukes, your host. Today, Mary Szczesinski of EcoSlow is telling us about their activities after 50 years of promoting a resilient ecosystem and healthy lifestyle in San Luis Obispo County. They're promoting interdependencies of natural systems, human health, and the local community. Mary, welcome to the Nonprofit Story.
Thank you so much.
Mary Szczesinski, our executive director, I want you to tell us a little bit about EcoSlow.
EcoSlow stands for the Environmental Center of San Luis Obispo. We were loosely formed over 50 years ago, but we are actually celebrating our 50th anniversary this year. 1971 is when EcoSlow officially became an organization. So that's a really exciting milestone. And EcoSlow serves all of San Luis Obispo County. So we try and do programs in various areas and or support coalition work.
So tell us some of the local issues that EcoSlow addresses as a nonprofit organization.
One thing that we're known for is putting on the biggest volunteer event each September, which definitely had to pivot last year because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Mm-hmm. But typically we bring 1,500 to 2,000 volunteers all across Slo County to do a one-day data-driven cleanup. And that's part of International Coastal Cleanup Day. So there's cleanups happening all over the planet in September every year. And here locally, we've been coordinating that event for the past 16 years. We love this event. The community loves this event, but it also helps raise awareness about what items are in our community. What do we need to bring awareness about in regards to what's ending up in the environment that shouldn't end up in the environment, and use that as a platform to advocate for what needs to change with our systems. For example, plastic bottle caps are something we find all the time. And there's been kind of a movement the past couple of years of, if we're going to produce water bottles, can we quote unquote leash the lid on them, because they keep falling off and this is really dangerous to wildlife because they're such a small plastic trash item.
So tell us, is this just on the beach that you're cleaning up, or you're cleaning up all the other areas also?
Because it's Coastal Cleanup Day, it kind of indicates that it's a coastal or beach location cleanup. What we've really tried to do is work with lots of different partners across Slo County to bring more inland cleanup, because we all know nature's connected and nature knows no boundaries. So if there's trash in the street, it's going to go into a storm drain. If there's trash at a park, it's going to blow its way into a creek and the creek feeds into the ocean. So we've worked to add some of our county parks. We've worked with some of the local municipalities for cleanups in their parks. And some of these organizations have been doing cleanups anyways. It's just trying to work together and make the event stronger and more spread out across Slo County. So while the name Coastal Cleanup Day indicates the coast, we've actually changed the name locally to be Creeks to Coast Cleanup to really highlight from the creeks to the coast and everything in between.
You think you're going to come back at the end of 2021 in September?
We are cautious about what we're going to be able to organize in September. What we were able to do last year, which we are definitely planning to do this year, is put together cleanup kits for households, whether that's a family or roommates or something. Mm-hmm. So they have everything that they need to go to their local park or their favorite beach or their downtown area and do a cleanup on their own. So we distributed nearly 300 cleanup kits last year. Mm-hmm. And I think we picked up around just over 5,000 pounds of trash throughout the county, where normally we're picking up almost double of that. But we were able to pivot and do something that was COVID safe. So we are planning to do that no matter what. And we're just going to have to kind of see how summertime goes before we can talk about in-person events and whatnot. We want to keep the safety of the community first.
If somebody wants to get a cleanup kit, how do they find out about it?
So they can visit our website, which is ecoslow.org, or they can go ahead and send us an email or give us a call. So our email is info@ecoslow.org, or our phone number is 805-544-1777. And we'll start signups this summer, but you're welcome to contact us now and get on the list ahead of time, because they were definitely popular last year.
What are some of the other issues that EcoSlow pays attention to?
I like to say that as an environmental center, there's a lot of issues that touch the environment, that touch nature, whether that's wildlife, water, air, land, transportation, and everything in between. So it's been really important for EcoSlow over the past 50 years to build coalition, especially with community groups or that pop up around a certain issue, or organizations that come together for certain issues. So something we try and pride ourselves on, or try and foster too, is being that kind of hub. Like if we don't have the program or if we're not super involved in the advocacy work, we know who is and we can direct people to that.
Seems to be a lot of different organizations in our community interested in the environment. Do you find yourselves crossing over each other, or you find that everybody is being able to touch on some different issues?
Folks haven't checked out what's called the hub on our website. It's a great resource. It's a great directory of organizations that are local. And if you're interested in a particular issue, there's an organization here that's doing it, whether it's gardening or wildlife or everything I was saying before. But I think that directory, which we put together over the past few years, has helped create coalition. And one of the local organizations like Green Space and Ecologistics, I know that they both link to that page from their websites because they want to help promote this directory, for lack of a better term, because it's kind of a one-stop shop for a lot of organizations that are doing environmentally minded work in Slo County. So it's really specific to our area. And what we find at EcoSlo is it's really dependent on the issues. One thing we could highlight is the recent decision by the Coastal Commission to phase out off-road vehicles over the next 3 years in Oceano Dunes. The decision was made March 18th at a special Coastal Commission meeting, and EcoSlo has probably been in coalition with groups for the 40 years that issue has been going on. But recently, in the past 2 years, I want to say, an alliance called the Dunes Alliance formed, which really brought local organizations as well as national organizations together around the concern of the habitat destruction, loss, air quality, and everything in between. But this was a working group of several organizations like Sierra Club, Surfrider, like EcoSlo, that came together to really advocate around this issue and bring a really strong front as a group. And again, you know, this has been on and off for 40 years, but I think the past 2 years, we were all able to form coalition, bring our different strengths, and get the community involved. Also, the Oceano Beach Community Association became involved. So it wasn't just quote unquote environmental organizations. It was community organizations or groups that were formed around specific issues, but we were all able to talk about and come together on kind of multifaceted issues to bring awareness, to do advocacy and whatnot. So many of our groups are just so thrilled with that decision. We're looking forward to what the dunes will look like with more walkable access for the community.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Dr. Consuelo Mukes is speaking with EcoSlo's Mary Szczynski.
Are you connected with doing anything with Earth Day or bringing special awareness to Earth Day within our community?
Yeah, so this year it's definitely different because of the COVID-19 pandemic. But something we were doing last year and we're planning to do this year too is just encouraging folks to find ways to celebrate the Earth. Earth Day is on April 22nd, but I really it's Earth Month. So let's celebrate all month long. And obviously we need to be doing things to take care of the environment all year long. Mm-hmm. But I think it's finding ways to celebrate the Earth in a way that works for people, especially in a pandemic this year, because we can't gather at a local festival or an event that EcoSlo used to put on. We used to put on a volunteer event with a few organizations in April to celebrate. I think one of the things that folks can do, and maybe this sounds a little simple, but this is like such a great time of year in Slo County because of the wildflowers that are out in open space trails and just all over Slo County. This is just such a beautiful time of year. So what better way to celebrate than to see some of those wildflowers that we only see for a month every year? And there's just great spots. I was up in Cambria last weekend and was exploring the trails there and was out at Felsman Loop this weekend and saw so many wildflowers. So that's one way to celebrate, I think, on your own time this year.
You know, you have a really good recycling resources page, and I know people are very interested in that. Tell us a little bit about that and how that helps to support your mission.
Interestingly enough, EcoSlo formed around local advocacy issues, but one of the first things our organization did was form a recycling center. And we were the recycling center for Slo County for the first half of our history, 20, 25 years. I have to go back in time and imagine life without blue bins, because blue bins haven't been around forever. So legend has it is that board members on the weekend had con- created some sort of can crushing system or whatever, and they would volunteer on the weekends and crush cans and collect glass. And eventually we dipped our toes into newspaper recycling. It's in the roots of EcoSlow, is around recycling. This is before plastic was so inundated in our society that they weren't even recycling plastic. Think about 70s, 80s, 90s. It wasn't that prevalent. And I think back to, you know, obviously I wasn't around when EcoSlow started, but I think about, they don't talk about they were recycling plastic. They were doing glass, aluminum, and newspaper. So fast forward to today, and, you know, we've had blue bins probably maybe since the 90s. And that's one system to put all of the recyclables in, is in this blue bin, curbside, and the garbage company is picking it up and bringing it to a facility, which is usually called, this is a little technical, but usually called a MRF, which stands for Materials Recovery Facility. And that facility separates out paper, aluminum, glass, plastic, and bales it up and ships it to folks who want to use those materials so they have another life. So I've been with EcoSlow almost 6 years. And what I really realized when I first started at EcoSlow is that we were getting a lot of questions about how to dispose of things, or how to recycle things, or what can be done in this county? Where do I go? And we have a local waste management authority, the IWMA. And so we've been able to connect with them and try and connect more of the community to them, because they have a great resource on their website. If you can search anything and know if it needs to go into the trash or if it can be recycled in Slo County.
You have a couple of special new projects going on. Can you tell us quickly about some of those?
We have been doing virtual programs over the past year, and we have one coming up in early May that will talk about green waste and our local anaerobic digester. We also have programs that we've recorded and are on EcoSlow's YouTube channel that are a program around trash and recycle. So that is something we've been doing over the past year, is try and make that information accessible to the public. And it's all on our YouTube page, and they're 1 hour programs, and they're great. So I encourage folks to check those out.
And what about your trees? Are you into planting trees, or I think you're into some green business certifications?
Yeah. So two new programs are around, it's called the Green Business Program. It's part of a statewide network with the California Green Business Network. And this is a way for EcoSlow to work with businesses throughout San Luis Obispo County to help them become more green, whether that's saving energy, saving money, using different materials that are more eco-friendly. We've got a great resource list that we can provide businesses. And they go through kind of 7 different tiers to assess their operations, and we help green them up. And then they become a part of a special directory called the Green Business Directory that's not only put together locally, but put together across all of California.
People are interested in helping or donating to help you as a nonprofit. How can they do that?
Yeah, we've got so many ways to get involved with EcoSlow. Donations are much appreciated always. But if you're looking to get involved with a particular event, we can always use individual or business or organizational sponsorships to help make programs happen. We love our cleanup program, but it definitely needs funds to make it work so we can have it be the powerful program that it is. And as you were mentioning, we also have a new urban trees program. So there's a great way to get involved with helping take care of these trees. It's fairly easy to get them in the ground, but it's taking care of them. And we need not only volunteers, but also funds to help support those efforts so that these trees have a really nice long life. Like I said, you can visit our website, ecoslow.org, or send us an email or give us a call. And we've got so much stuff to get involved with that a lot of it ties back to climate work. We've got a great advocacy committee that, if that's something that you're really interested in, we have folks focusing on various issues around that. So I feel like, you know, whatever you're interested in, we probably have something. And if we don't, we've got the hub directory, and we can get you involved with another organization locally. And we'd love to do that too.
Fantastic. So I have been speaking with Mary Szczesinski, the executive director of EcoSlow. That's ecoslow.org. Mary, thank you for being on the Nonprofit Story with me today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. This is so fun.
This is Dr. Consuelo Mutes, your host.
On today's Working Lunch, we check in with Jeffrey Armstrong, president of Cal Poly.
Welcome to Working Lunch, the Slow Chambers weekly series where we give our community the opportunity to connect with some of the exciting people and things happening in our region. I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the Slow Chamber, and today we'll be having a conversation with Cal Poly's President, Jeffrey Armstrong. President Armstrong took over his role as President of Cal Poly in February of 2011, joining the Cal Poly team fresh off serving as the Dean of the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources and a professor of animal sciences at Michigan State University. Since taking over the head position at Cal Poly, President Armstrong has focused on growing the hands-on, learn-by-doing culture at the university, supporting and enhancing a campus culture of inclusivity and diversity, and helping drive economic innovation throughout the Central Coast region. Today, I'm excited to talk with President Armstrong about how he came to a career in education, lessons learned from this pandemic, and the future of Cal Poly. President Armstrong, thank you so much for being here.
Well, it's great to be here, Jim.
Before Cal Poly, you served as the dean and a professor in the ag department at Michigan State University for more than a decade. Can you give us a little background on kind of what drove you to be an educator?
Yeah, I grew up on a farm in Kentucky and really didn't know what college or the world was about. And I wanted to share this picture with you because it was because of FFA, and you could see this kind of cool 70 haircut. But I was involved in FFA, which used to be called Future Farmers of America. And my FFA advisor, Mr. Ray Fowler, he influenced both my older brother as we were both the first to go to college, you know, in our generation. And that's what got me excited in education. It got me excited about agriculture. And so I wanted to be a vet or an ag teacher and ended up doing neither, went to grad school at NC State. Became an animal scientist, learned immunology, physiology, so I know just enough to be dangerous about this crisis. And, you know, the rest is history, but it's amazing how people can influence your life. And it was this teacher, Ray Fowler, because I wouldn't be sitting here today if not for FFA, and went on to be a state officer. And, you know, different organizations, different people affect us all. Who's that Ray Fowler for somebody today? That's the cool part.
Was there a specific experience where you were, as you started to get into being a teacher, that made you more interested in transitioning to this administration side? Was it always part of the plan?
No, it really evolved. I was brought up just always do the best you could do. You can work harder than anybody in the room. You may not be the smartest one in the room, but actually there was a real interesting moment. I was a master's student at NC State. And I was fortunate enough to win a teaching award. The chancellor at the time, this was back during Jimmy Valvano, NC State, winning the national championship. The chancellor was Bruce Poulton. And he shook my hand and gave me the award and said, animal science. I used to be animal science. You too could be chancellor someday. And I say that to students all the time. If they're animal science or even other majors, I go, you know, you too could be president of the university someday. And I thought about it for maybe 20 seconds and forgot about it for years. But I'll never forget that.
And obviously you were there in Michigan State. You know, maybe tell me a little bit about your first impressions of St. Louis. Were you a regular visitor before you became president? Or was this just kind of like a job list?
Not a regular visitor at all. In fact, growing up in Kentucky, I worked on a farm in road construction. We didn't go on vacation. I mean, a day trip to see a Cardinals baseball game in St. Louis was a highlight, and that didn't happen every year. So my impression of California was all those TV shows at that time, which I won't name to date myself. But I had started looking at administrative positions, and anyway, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo came up. I knew a bit about Cal Poly from the ag side because I'd been so involved in that. I knew it was an amazing university. But our first visit, Sharon and I's first visit, was an interview in the fall of 2010. And Karen Webb, who's retired now, worked at Cal Poly. When she picked us up at the airport, two things that struck me. She said, it's freezing cold. And it was like 45 degrees and we're like in short sleeves. And then I said, I've never been to San Luis Obispo before. And she said, you pronounced it right. And I smiled and I said, I had a 50-50 chance. So we, Sharon and I, that was, we were one of the last CSU presidential positions to be filled through a really wide open search. And so we were there interviewing, and Sharon was right along with me, and we fell in love from the first moment.
Is there something that you look back and you miss most about Michigan?
Well, what we miss most is our family. You know, our Jessica, our daughter, and Zachary, our son, went to Michigan State, both doing really well. Zach's financial advisor, Jessica's an OBGYN, married a great Michigan young man, Dean, and we have two grandkids. So we miss the family more than anything. But one of the silver linings of the multiple clouds of COVID and all that's been happening is we've traveled back several times. We've seen our grandkids probably more due to COVID than we would have otherwise. And one of them was born during COVID, May 12th. So we test regularly. We're careful. Sharon and I are both been vaccinated now. And I do have to tell you, I miss those long, long days in the summer in Michigan. I mean, you can play golf till 9 o'clock at night or be out on a boat in the lake. But then the flip side of that is those short, short days in the winter. You go to work, it's dark, and you come home, it's dark. So Michigan's a great place, but San Luis Obispo is, it's home.
Educators really had to step up and work in a completely reimagined reality. Cal Poly was able to have a blend of that in-person and virtual classes. Did being able to see both versions create some clear takeaways or lessons as you look at education in the future?
Yeah, I'm proud of our students and our community on how we've handled this. I think we've gotten the big things right. But early on, you know, under the guidance of the CSU and great partnership with Dr. Penny Borenstein, Wade Horton in the county, you know, we've followed the science. We aligned ourselves with the science and the guidelines. And then we have a couple of experts, local community members, Dr. Trace Ritter, Kevin Ferguson. And we have really worked hard, first and foremost, to put public health and safety, protecting the vulnerable, and then student success. So we made a decision to have, you know, half of our capacity filled residence halls this academic year. We also have been offering in-person classes that the faculty chose and elected to teach that made sense. And it's worked well. Without that, we would have had all the students in the neighborhood and we would have had no requirement to test them. We've run over 170,000 tests. And this week we hit 98% compliance in our students that are coming to campus for any reason to test twice a week. So we're still getting a few cases, but the way to get rid of COVID is to identify it. So I'm really proud. And then we also have faculty and others that embrace virtual. Many were before and now they will. I think 100 years from now or 5 years from now or 10 years from now, we're still going to be that residential destination learn by doing campus. But students are going to be able to get through quicker. They're going to be able to go on an internship for a year instead of 6 months or 20 weeks instead of 10 weeks because they can take some virtual courses. Perhaps we'll have three-year degrees. All of those are for the faculty to discuss and think about, but it's very exciting what we can do and better serve. We need to serve more students. We turn away so many amazing students that want a Cal Poly degree, and we're doing a better job of serving the demographics of California by providing financial aid and scholarships. And thank you to many people listening who have helped with scholarships, who have helped us move forward in enhancing the Learn by Doing program at Cal Poly. So thank you.
Some folks have talked about the idea that college would eventually just go to this virtual level. It sounds like while some of it may take that form, there's never going to be a replacement for this idea that coming to campus and potentially being a part of it.
You know, our vision 2022, which is almost upon us, is to be a more diverse, more residential campus. We're largely first-time freshmen, 17, 18-year-olds from all over California, and about 16% out of state. Young people want to get out of home. They want to learn how to learn. And by increasing our financial aid, we're increasing the yield of high achieving, low income students from all over California that are coming here. And with that increasing aid, then they can live on campus for 2 years. Students do better if they live on campus for 2 years versus living that second year in the community. Some dispute that, but the data is clear, and it's especially clear for students that are in STEM majors, engineering, science, and math, and especially true for our economically disadvantaged students. So I see us being a residential campus 100 years from now, and it's part of San Luis Obispo, the community, the university. We work together. I'm really proud of our town-gown relationship.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. The San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce's Jim D'Antona is speaking with Cal Poly President Jeffrey Armstrong.
You talked a little bit about some of the great staff members you have who have worked with Penny Borenstein, and Cal Poly is applying that learn by doing directly to the medical challenge of COVID. Isn't there a testing procedure that's been pioneered on campus?
Yeah, so we have really key people. Anthony Knight is Director of Emergency Operations. Tina Hadaway-Millis leads our campus health and well-being and all infectious disease response on campus. Dr. Aydin Nazmi is an epidemiologist. Dr. Nathaniel Martinez in biology and his colleagues, they have developed saliva-based PCR tests. And it is very, very cool. It is economical, and PCR, polymerase chain reaction, that's the gold standard. So this is a test that's like 94, 97% specificity, sensitivity. We get the results turned around in less than 24 hours, and the students just have to provide that saliva sample. So I'm very proud of how the team has worked. And then there's a whole group of people that have worked on the IT, the collection of the samples, the logistics. We have a group of people that have been on the phone answering questions through our corporation. I mean, I could spend the next 15 minutes just listing names, but I'm really proud of them. And I'm also proud of the partnership with the city and the county. We've had great discussions with Derek Johnson, as well as I mentioned, Wade and Penny, and very responsive. You know, we have the Alternative Care Center, ACS, set up in our recreation center. We didn't know from the beginning, but thankfully we haven't had to use it. I mean, it could have scaled to 900 people, and now it's kind of in a dormant, quiet stage of around, you know, 180 beds, and we're keeping that there as our insurance policy for a while. Again, no one knew going in where this would go. It's been difficult. Everybody knows someone who's been impacted. It also could have been much, much, much worse.
You talked about the 170,000 tests. The way that we're going to contain this virus is the vaccinations and knowing who's sick and when. It looks like also that the folks who are living on campus have less viruses versus people living off campus.
Yeah, our prevalence has routinely been lower than the county prevalence. And on campus has been lower than off campus. And we're getting a few cases now, but we're testing way, way more than the citizens of the county are testing now. And it's not a capacity issue of the county, it's just people testing. But again, we have the ability to require students that are coming on campus to test. So we're going to continue that. If the prevalence drops, then we can lower the frequency of testing. And then once CDC provides clear guidance and we get additional students vaccinated, then we'll stop testing vaccinated students. But right now, the guidance is not clear. So out of an abundance of caution, even vaccinated individuals are tested. I've had my first Moderna. Sharon has had hers. We're both testing as well.
You've made diversity, equity, inclusion a key aspect of your work as president. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the tactics you've implemented or exploring to ensure that Cal Poly is that safe, welcoming place for all people?
Yeah, one of the first things we've done, and we've had two different campus climate surveys, is really looking at climate. We also implemented a few years ago, if you're going to serve on a search committee, then you had to undergo and participate in implicit bias training. So we've worked hard to try to diversify our faculty and staff. And then as we've looked at the demographics of our student body, we found we are the least diverse public university in California, not across the US, but our measure is California. But we also found that we're the most expensive public university in California net of financial aid. That's why we started Cal Poly Scholars in 2012. And we now have 1,000 Cal Poly Scholars, some partially funded by donors, chamber members, parents, faculty, corporations. Those students come from high schools where the majority of students are on free or reduced lunch. And these are high achieving, economically disadvantaged students that receive all their fees or $5,000 per year. They receive some technical support, advising, and the data to date shows there's no equity gap in their persistence. So 94%, 95% retention after the first year, which is very, very good, is one example of what we're doing. We also have donors who have stepped up and working through the California Community Foundation, a non-affiliated Cal Poly Foundation, providing scholarships for URM, African-American, LGBTQ plus students, women in engineering. And they can do that because they are not bound by Prop 209. And so that's going on, and there's been several million dollars. And we'll have some announcements of some very significant gifts coming up in the next few weeks that will impact next fall. So we've made progress, but we have a lot of work to do. And then we want to grow jobs in the community. So more of these amazing Hispanic, Latino, African-American, Native American, Indigenous, Hawaiian, Pacific Islander, women in engineering, all students have a job and they could stay in our community. But we want Cal Poly to be for everyone.
Are you noticing within some of the different groups that you need to address cultural issues, whether it's community or otherwise?
Yeah, it's a multi-pronged approach. The Cal Poly Scholars, we'll have 676 coming in next fall. Based on the data to date, those students will be about 85% non-white, majority 55% Hispanic, Latino, Asian American. They'll be first generation majority. And so that group is increasing. But if you look at other URM groups, women in engineering, you really have to have Prop 209 compliant ways to do that. And we absolutely adhere to Prop 209. But that's where donors and other partners and other strategies come into play. So it's also important to recognize climate, that you look at students that are of similar economic status, our yield tends to be higher in white students and lower in students of color. And so that's not a financial issue. It's related to being a destination campus, perceived climate, real climate issues that are in our community and on our campus. And we need to recognize them and listen to those learned, lived experiences of people and learn from others. And that's what college is about, coming here, learning from others. And diversity and inclusion is good for everyone. It makes teams better. It makes companies better. It makes Cal Poly better. It's not about checking a box. It's about what's right. It's about serving California. It's not a political issue. It is a human being issue or a human issue.
In addition to diversity, equity, and inclusion, are there other values you're proud of to infuse in this organization?
Well, I came into a situation where we had an amazing university, President Baker, 31 years, Cal Poly stature, the quality. I'm just impressed with the hard work, the tenacity and the caring of our faculty and staff and how they deeply care for student success. Students come to Cal Poly, they're going to have the attention of faculty and staff. They'll be in that classroom with them. It's going to be a class size that they can manage. We're just working very hard to try to get better and stay focused on faculty and staff success, because you can't have student success without that. And so I'm really very intent on growing jobs, working with the chamber, with REACH, our local economic development committee. We need to grow jobs because increasing beds on campus is not just about student success. It's about taking pressure off the community so more and more of the homes in San Luis Obispo can be available for faculty and staff. But we also have to figure out a way to provide higher pay for our faculty and staff. And it is a struggle for people today, but we were able to put about $5.5 million into equity and support of our faculty and staff over the past years. But that was only a start. It is difficult for so many people to live in our community, and we've got to increase those head of household jobs for partner spousal accommodation. And that's true, not just for Cal Poly, but for healthcare, for K through 12, community college, Cuesta and Hancock. We've got to work to provide more slots for transfer students in our community as well. So it's an exciting time. So many exciting things that we can do, and we can do better. This community is amazing, but we can all do better.
That was the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce's Jim D'Antona speaking with Cal Poly President Jeffrey Armstrong. Finally, let's get an update on the San Luis Obispo County Libraries. They've been adapting their programs to best serve the needs of Central Coast residents.
Hello, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we're joined by Erica Thatcher, Outreach and Marketing Librarian for the San Luis Obispo County Library. Welcome, Erica.
Hi, Brian. Thanks.
I always enjoy talking to you because we talk about libraries, and which are a big passion for me, especially now in these hard times, these COVID times, how libraries can help people, the challenges that the libraries face, people using them face. There are several programs coming up that are pretty exciting. The Book to Action program, tell me about that.
Book to Action is a program sponsored by California Center for the Book, but we want to give big shout-outs to the Cambria, Arroyo Grande, San Luis Obispo, and Atascadero Friends of the Library groups because they're supporting this program too this year. It's our annual intergenerational community reads program, and our aim is to just connect readers to current issues, agencies, and organizations in our community that would be great resources. This year, for 2021, our selection is the book Stamped, Racism, Anti-Racism, and You, and that is co-authored, actually, by best-selling authors Jason Reynolds and Ibram X. Kendi. It's written for young adults. It has intergenerational appeal. Adults are loving it, too.
Is it a fiction or non?
It's nonfiction. Mm-hmm. The authors call it, it's not a history book, but it kind of connects the dots of racism from the beginning and to the present day.
Young adult novels are kind of a unique genre. I mean, first and foremost, what is a young adult? Is it an 11-year-old or an 18-year-old? What are the kinds of things that those youth are interested in or worried about? And I think we can argue that probably the ages, say 10 or 11 until you're 19 or 20, are probably the most tumultuous in a person's life. And so a good book that gives good ideas, useful ideas, is super important. But there's a lot of controversy surrounding young adult material because some parents are fine having their children read things which are a little edgy, and some are not. Do you have a way to deal with that?
Because of the age range, it's hard to choose a book for a young adult. You know, some of them are a little bit more socially advanced. It's good to check in with a librarian. We always can tell what books would be appropriate, and we know where to look to find good reviews and ratings. One of the resources we usually use is called commonsensemedia.org, and they always give a real good breakdown of what a book is about, what ratings from kids, ratings from adults.
So the other element of this that I think is so intriguing is the theme of racism. And I do think it's courageous, important that the library and these other institutions are taking on such a timely and important subject.
And this program is pretty cool because we don't really take the role of social activists. We just are here to connect folks to popular, current, you know, sometimes controversial issues. Anti-racism books have been, you know, bestsellers this last year and really popular with our readers. This program is also just kind of an invitation for folks to read and consider. You know, people may not agree with everything in the book, in Book to Action, but we think it's a really good starting point for reflection and discussion. Some of these books that we choose for Book to Action, this is our fourth year now, so We do choose challenging books, so it's good to share those ideas.
Let's talk about the Tale Trails program.
Tale Trails is an outdoor interactive reading experience. It's where readers can enjoy a story page by page along a trail. But what's exciting is that our youth services department has partnered with the city of San Luis Obispo to bring Tale Trails to three San Luis Obispo city parks. And that's during the month of April, May, and June. So April's book is Something Wonderful by local author Matt Ritter and local illustrator Niall Gonzalez. And that's at Meadow Park in San Luis Obispo. And then May's book is The Three Billy Goats Buenos at Duval Park. And then June's book is Bea's Bees at Islay Park.
I'd like to remind everybody, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we're joined by Erica Thatcher, Outreach and Marketing Librarian for the SLO County Library. If a family were on one of these trails or one of these parks, what would they see?
It almost looks like real estate signs. They're set out along the trail with laminated pages inserted into the sign frames. Mm-hmm. So you can go as fast or slow as you want. You can read out loud. You can read to yourself. People have really been enjoying them, their picture books. So they are shorter.
Would each stop along the trail include the entire book?
Yes, it's all laminated, the entire book, mostly illustrations. So it's very visual.
There is a certain demographic that is bedrock public library users, and that would be families with young children. It's a ritual that probably goes back hundreds of years, but a very healthy one, where the child being brought to the library and at a certain point getting their very first library card is a very healthy and heartwarming thing. And anytime you can engage parents and children around books and reading and ideas, it's a slam dunk. What a great idea.
Yeah, so shout out to SLO Parks and Rec for the collaboration.
Also a shout out to the city of SLO, which provides many unique support avenues for the library. As we approach summer, tell us about the summer reading program in general and how it works.
Our summer reading program runs June 1st through July 31st, and it will look a lot different this year. We are doing a summer reading to go. So it'll be more like grab-and-go bags that have library goodies, some books, some self-guided projects, and instructions on how to track your time online and get entered into drawings for big prizes. This year it'll be easy. We're not requiring registration. And
summer months are always a time of a little bit of a decline or a stagnation, if nothing else, of a child's learning skills and school-related activities, and that's normal. But the summer reading program and just using the library in any a myriad of other ways is an important mechanism to keep the kids engaged, be more ready to go back to school in the fall.
We like to think we're helping prevent summer slide.
Now, another interesting thing that the library is doing is new designs.
Library cards. We have new designs for 2021. We collaborated with the San Luis Obispo County Arts Council for three new card designs, and local artists Craig P. Sherborne, Alyssa Madren, and Ken Christensen created the new looks. So these cards are available to anyone who is new to the library or any library user who would like a new card or needs a replacement card.
Excellent. Now, as we get closer to the summer and also in a better place COVID-wise, what are some of the things that people young and old should expect or not expect at their branch libraries?
Right now, most of our staff is still on assignment with the county for COVID-19 tasks and duties. So they're not in the libraries. They are working at vaccine sites and doing contact tracing. They're still out there. But we're slowly getting staff back, which means we will be able to hopefully open up our doors soon. Right now, our services are super limited. We are offering sidewalk service, which means you can place holds at slolibrary.org and then pick them up at the front door. Four locations are open right now: the San Luis Obispo Library, Arroyo Grande, Tascadero, and Morro Bay Libraries are open 9 to 5. Tuesday through Saturday. So you can still place holds and pick them up. And of course, our ebooks and audiobooks, our digital library books, are available 24/7.
In any kind of an emergency, all county employees are potentially subject to working outside their normal duties because it is an emergency. And I'm very happy and proud to say when we were finally able to get our vaccinations at Cuesta College, there were two library staff there that I'm acquainted
with. Right.
I shouldn't bring this up, but do you have any kind of a guesstimate about being able to borrow from Black Gold Libraries again in the near future?
I don't have any news on that right now. So we're hoping to have an exhibition this summer at this downtown location in San Luis Obispo. So fingers crossed. We do have staff answering phones at our libraries. So we are here to answer any questions you might have.
What would you like our audience to know about the library?
We miss our patrons. We miss being at our libraries. We are really looking forward to opening the libraries this summer.
This has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by Erica Thatcher, Outreach and Marketing Librarian for the County of San Luis Obispo Public Library. Thank you, Erica.
Thanks, Brian.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.